You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Alice McDermott, the author of At Weddings and Wakes. She also wrote The Bigamist's Daughter and That Night. You know, I've been thinking that more than many of the writers who write about family, you know, when I was growing up and reading, the serious writers were writing about people who were raised as goats and who, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But you really do shape sentences according to the subject that you're writing about. It seems to me here that the sentence style is one of constant suspension and interruption, and that that's sort of the theme of this book, too, about a family that's always being interrupted by what it's lost and what it had. I wondered, you know, is it conscious? Do you work out a sentence structure that becomes the thematic of the book?
No, I don't think so. I think that the language and the themes develop together. I would have to know the theme in order to know. I guess I'd have to know the theme first in order to get the sentences to match. And I don't know the theme first, so it's voice is very important to me, and the sound of the language and the sentence probably has more bearing on what the story actually is about. Mm-hmm. Than the story shaping the language. So it's, for me, it's listening to the sound of the language and through that getting to know the characters and the situation.
But for instance, in this book, you know, there's the weight of memory that is, in a way, the subject of the book, and the language in its texture and its thickness and the density of the sentences and paragraphs are there, and from time to time, as if from the midst of all of this textured and velvety reference, you'll hear a character speaking a half sentence like, he's not the man I married.
Yes.
So it's almost as if the past is sort of coming between the reader and the character, and only occasionally, at least at the beginning of the book, do you get these bursts of exactly what's going on in the fewest possible words, and it seemed to me like that doesn't happen accidentally.
No, it's not accident, but it's all in the development. It's not something I think that I can say, okay, it's time to feed a half line here, so that there's a sense that there's something actually going on. It's more organic than, I'm in California, mm-hmm. I can say organic. it's more organic than that. It's just working together. And I think the prose in this novel was really acted more as a signpost for me of what was going on in the characters' lives and what the atmosphere of each scene would be like.
Because it seemed, you know, incredibly lovely to me. And I guess this is what I like about your books. In That Night, two-thirds of the way through, it's revealed, this is no longer a secret, that the narrator is someone who lived across the street and watched the scene of passion, and that her own life has been without that night.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the feeling of loss and, you know, surprise and loneliness that comes from that is here too in many of the details. Around halfway through the book, there's a story of a figure. People live next door and they see a figure sitting on a roof. Well, you can tell a little bit about it.
That's my Stephen King chapter. As close as I'll ever get to anything like that. It seems to me that particular chapter is typical of the sort of stories that parochial school children would tell one another in the schoolyard. And it was it's about a little boy telling his friends in the schoolyard about a neighbor of his cousin, nicely removed so the story couldn't really be questioned, a neighbor of his cousin who just happened to glance out the window through a stained glass window in her home and see a figure sitting in the window of the house across the driveway, and through over a number of days finding that the figure's always there and that there's no one else in the house, and the woman who actually lives in the house is quite startled by this. She comes over and looks, and finally, of course, a priest is called, and it's never quite decided. A second priest comes in, and his very practical suggestion is, well, just get rid of the window, which is what this boy says that his aunt has decided to do. They're going to take out the stained glass window so they don't have to see this figure. But there is, I think, that through that scene, there is that sense of something there.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
But also in the novel, the sense that something necessary, which people need to see when they look out a stained glass window, is not there.
Yes.
That there's been like a vanishing point in which some item of faith, which some of the family want to believe is still there,
yes,
can't be found.
Yes.
And yet they're going through their daily motions as if the center had not been subtracted, as if it had not disappeared somehow.
Right.
So that the story becomes sort of an emblem,
yes,
for the whole,
yes,
novel.
Yes. It was really important to me. I think one of the primary impulses for this novel was to talk or try to get a sense of what goes on between generations, but more important, what gets lost. I suppose I felt that I was reading a lot of fiction, a lot of contemporary fiction, and especially anything that was an ethnic sort of work, and it seemed an awareness of the past is fully delivered to the next generation in the stories that are told. And I think I was balking against that. Yeah, the stories get passed on, but things get lost. Things drop out between generations, and that's inevitable. And I think that's the struggle for most of the characters in this novel is that frustration, the inability to really express what you felt, what you lived through. And the stories don't do it. The matriarch of this family, who's constantly saying how all these bad things that happened, the bad luck that I had, and her daughters are saying yes, yes, and her grandchildren are saying yes, we know that story, yes, oh, it was terrible. And I think her frustration is, yes, but you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know the story, but you don't know.
Well, what dazzled me, I was very pleased by this, is that she comes to be the second wife of a man her own sister had married.
Right.
And the way she asserts her difference from her sister had been by disagreeing with,
yes,
him. Gradually,
yes,
she becomes a disagreeing woman.
Yes.
Years later, the husband is dead, and she's with her grandchildren, and she's still being contentious, and you sense she wants them to disagree,
yes,
too. She wants an argument, but,
yes,
the children are so frightened of her that they're all sitting there very good, you know,
exactly,
with their hands
agreeing,
on the,
yes,
table,
yes,
agreeing, and that,
yes,
what disappeared and what she can't say is her need for an opponent,
yes,
you know, someone,
yes,
to define,
yeah,
herself from.
But that disagreement was exactly her courtship. That's also what she's trying to do. I mean, that's where the passion that they,
yes,
eventually
that it wasn't
had
flowers,
arose from. It,
yeah,
wasn't flowers. It was but that's never known. I mean, that's one of those things. Her own daughters recall that time of a time, well, when their father and mama, their stepmother, were always yelling at each other. All they can read, the oldest daughter remembers being woken up in the middle of the night with the two of them yelling at each other. And the story she tells about that, the memory she has about that, is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They were yelling at each other, but they were falling in love with each other, too. They were arguing about anything as a way to as you say, for her to distinguish herself, and for them to start a new life after her sister and his first wife had died.
I'm talking to Alice McDermott, the author of At Weddings and Wakes, recently published by Farrah Straus and Giroux. It seems to me that from The Bigamous Daughter to At Weddings and Wakes, there's often a secret manuscript in your books. here, it's the... It's the dead mothers who barely has been known by any of the children,
yes,
really. But there's a yearning to express that goes on in these books, whether the people are writers or not.
Yes.
Notebooks that get hidden, and I love the image of the notebook that gets cemented into a particle board wall
that
is made into a new room for the daughter who chooses to be an invalid. You know, almost as if you know that the messages she needs are in the barrier that she's erected.
Yes, exactly.
But could you talk about that urge to write, that need to write, that even people who are not writers have?
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to that whole storytelling, the impulse of storytelling to express the life that you've lived, and also the insufficiency of it. What it doesn't express, what doesn't get passed on, what it doesn't tell, and I think maybe in some ways this is my way of beginning to explain to myself what storytelling is all about. But I think it is that impulse that's constantly frustrated, and you can't get it. No matter how many times I tell you the story, you can't get what I really felt. You've got your own life. Everyone who's telling stories in At Weddings and Wake is always aware of the present and the future pulling the listener away. Fred the mailman tries to talk about his mother who has died of cancer to the women in the suburbs that he delivers mail to. And they're very sympathetic and they listen, but look, the kids are coming home from school and it's getting late and, you know, Fred, you've already told us this story. And there's always that pulling away. And I guess that it's just that. It's just that impulse to make known what can never really be known except in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I was particularly impressed with in this book is the way in which, from the very beginning, the mother of the young children here, what is her name?
Lucy.
Uh-huh. Travels to her sister's and her mother's house, and her mother is not her mother. And much of what is seen through the book is seen through half-closed doors.
Yes.
Or seen waiting for the light to go out in the slit beneath the doorway. It seemed like narrative was being pushed from center stage, and what was being spotlighted in this book is the ways in which people gather their information.
Yes, yes.
And that was very moving to me. I guess what I'm trying to say is that often when I read a family book, I'm afraid that the emotions in it and the memories are going to overwhelm the aesthetics. But what I like about your books is that they seem to me as deeply shaped and metaphorically about storytelling as much more ferociously formal books are said to be.
Uh-huh.
Do you agree with that?
Yes,
or is
I
it
can see that. Yes. I think that I'm aware. I think that probably a lot of contemporary novelists are. But I'm aware of the competition, of how many stories are being told to us all the time. Straight, heart-rending, chronological stories. You can get them anywhere, you know. And I like to think that I can remind us and readers through a novel of what only the written word can do, the kind of story that you can only get through a novel, that you're not going to get in the movies, that you're not going to get on Phil Donahue when people are confessing and talking about their families, or in a newspaper article, or just the things that really only the written word can do. And that's very important to me, and that's why I like to play with structure and time and look at stories in maybe oblique ways, not the straight narrative. And there were times In my own hesitations when I was writing At Weddings and Wakes and thinking, you know, you could really start on the boat, you know, and have the immigrants coming over and have a chapter in New York and in the early 20s and in the tenements, and then move on to the 40s and if it didn't turn into A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, it would be a much more accessible story perhaps. But that's not enough. I mean, we've had those stories.
Yeah, I think so, and I do think that the content of that chronology is not the story that you're telling.
Yes.
I think the story that you're telling is in the way that it's told, just as these daughters who find who are given a bag of sugared almonds of very beautiful colors and in a net bag, and who finally eat them, discover that the almonds don't taste very good covered with sugar. And although they don't eat all of them, that now the bag is torn open and it's not as beautiful as it was. It had been arranged in this way, right, that its inaccessibility was part of what was desirable
absolutely
about it.
Absolutely, yes. Oh, thank you. I'm glad you saw that.
Well,
no one's ever mentioned the almonds before.
Well, no, I'm relieved because, you know, these are the things, I guess, that I like about your books. And when they're written about, they're written as if something much more sentimental were going on in them.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? I have the feeling that the people who write about them, this is true of Ann Tyler, I think, as well, write as if... My sense is that both the work of Ann Tyler and your own is about loss, and the jokes are like ways in which all the winsomeness,
yes,
and
yes,
certain adorable moments are there to punctuate the vacancy of what's gone.
Yes.
But instead, when the books get written about, they get written about as if the idiosyncrasy were at the center,
yes,
and not the vacancy, not
yes
the loss or the void. And I always feel very sad because it's... Well, I think critics should recognize these things.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I wanted people to hear the texture of this prose, and I wanted to... introduce this opening section from At Weddings and Wakes by saying that Alice McDermott has mentioned that the prose tone here was inspired by looking at Maurice Sendak's In the Night Kitchen. Maurice has been on the show many times and has become a dear friend, so I was very happy, you know. I felt
taking
that.
Taking my inspiration
yes
from... I take it from wherever I can find it. That's a great place to take it.
Alice McDermott reading from At Weddings and Wakes.
Twice a week in every week of summer, except the last in July and the first in August, their mother shut the front door, the white 8-panel door that served as backdrop for every Easter, First Holy Communion, confirmation, and graduation photo in the family album, and with the flimsy screen leaning against her shoulder, turned the key in the black lock, gripped the curve of the elaborate wrought iron handle that had been sculpted to resemble a black vine curled into a question mark, and in what seemed a brief but accurate imitation of a desperate housebreaker, rung the door on its hinges until, well satisfied, she turned, slipped away from the screen as if she were throwing a cloak from her shoulders, and said, "Let's go." Down the steps the three children went before her, the screen door behind them easing itself closed with what sounded like three short, sorrowful expirations of breath. The two girls in summer dresses and white sandals, the boy in long khaki pants and a thin white shirt, button-down collar and short sleeves. She herself wore a cotton shirtwaist and short white gloves and heels that clicked against the concrete of the driveway and the sidewalk and sent word across the damp morning lawns that the Dalys, Lucy and the three children, were once again on their way to the city. The neighborhood at this hour was still and fresh and full of birdsong, and the children marked the 10 shady blocks to the bus with three landmarks. The first was the ragged hedge of the Lynch's corner lot, where lived, in a dirty house made ramshackle by four separate slapdash additions, 10 children, 3 grandparents, a mother, a father, and a bachelor uncle, who was responsible, no doubt, for the shattered brown bottle that lay on the edge of the driveway. The second was a slate path that intersected a neat green lawn, each piece of slate the exact smooth color, either lavender or gray or pale yellow, of a Necco candy wafer. Third was the steel 8-foot fence at the edge of the paved playground of the school they had all attended until June and would attend again in September, although it appeared to them as they passed it now as something forlorn and defeated, something that the wind might take away, something that could rumble with footsteps and shriek with bells and hold them in its belly for 6 hours each day, only in the wildest, the most terrible, the most unimaginable, and indeed not one of the three even imagined it as they passed, of dreams. At the bus stop, the tall white sign with its odd, flat, perforated pole drew them like magnets. They touched it, towing the pebbles at its base. They jumped up to slap its face. They held it in one hand and leaned out into the road looking for the first glint of sun against the white crown and wide black windshield of the bus that would take them to the avenue. Their mother smoked a cigarette on the sidewalk behind them, as she did on each of these mornings. Her pocketbook hung in the crook of her arm, the white gloves she would pull on as soon as the bus appeared, squeezed together in her free hand. The sun at 9:15 had already begun to push its heat through the soles of her stockings and beneath the fabric-covered cardboard of her belt. She touched the silver metal of its buckle, breathed in to gain a moment's space between fabric and flesh. Across the street, a deli and a bar and a podiatrist office shared a squat brick building that was shaded by trees. Beyond it, a steeple rose, the gray steeple of the Presbyterian Church, into a sky that was blue and cloudless. Swinging from the bus stop sign, the children failed to imagine for their mother, just as they had failed to imagine for the building where they went to school, any other life but the still, unpredictable one she presented on those mornings, although even as she dropped her cigarette to her side and stepped on the butt with her first step toward them, it was a woman's subtle, sneaky way of finishing a smoke, she was aware of the stunned hopelessness with which she moved, of time draining itself from the scene in a slow leak.
Alice McDermott reading from the opening passages of At Weddings and Wakes. I discovered when I was looking through the collected stories of Thomas Williams, I think this morning, that you were one of his students. And, you know, he seems to me to be a really tragically overlooked writer.
Yes.
You know, The Hair
yes.
of Harold Rue is really one of my favorite American
yes.
books. And that you kind of share with him that relationship between the stories of fiction and the stories people tell about themselves.
Uh-huh.
And the actual shape of life and the way it resists storytelling. I wondered whether you liked him as a teacher and what you felt about him.
Yes. The thing that always comes to mind with Tom, and it's something it comes to mind quite often because I pass it on so often to my own students now. The very first story I had written for him was, I thought, rather wry and charming, which gave me the courage to show it to him in the first place when I was a graduate student up there. It was supposed to be a funny story, and I suppose it was funny in some ways. And after he read it and mentioned that it was rather funny and some of the details were very nice, he said, you know, but this character is your puppet. And he started talking about the character in this short story as if he were a real person. And he felt sorry for him that I hadn't been kind enough to him and that I hadn't looked at him more closely and that I had let him stay on the surface and that I was sort of laughing at him. And it was a revelation to me. It was so wonderful, number one, to have someone read your work and take the character that seriously. But it was a real lesson for me, too, that if you're going to do this, you've got to enter your characters fully. And if you ever hold them at arm's length, your writing will suffer because of it. And that's certainly, you can see that in Tom's work itself. I hear myself again and again reading stories, especially you can see in beginning fiction writers, you always want to keep the characters at arm's length because it might get a little bit uncomfortable if you don't. And I hear myself saying, you know, this character is your puppet.
But it's almost as if in his fiction he'll supply a set of puppets and then a set of real people.
Yes.
And
yes.
ask you to see the difference
yes,
between
exactly.
what life does to us and what fiction what
yes.
does to us.
Yes,
and
that's very
that's
important.
Here too, you know, that this sense, I guess that there is a central story here. It's a story that happens before really the book is underway, the story of Aunt May. And it's a story of why ultimately a woman goes every day from Long Island to see her mother in Brooklyn, what it is that has happened to bring her there, and why, although there's really nothing that can be pointed at that's wrong, she says of her husband, he's not the man I married.
Yes.
And it's something, you know, again, I don't mean to criticize critics, but, you know, it seemed to me to be that space that the reader has to read into and discover, and that the book is built around, again, that unexplained moment.
Yes.
But it's not the point that nothing's wrong. The point is that she can't say what's wrong, and she can't tell it in a story that will convince her sisters.
That's
it
right.
hasn't become part of family history.
That's right. Yes.
Oh, good. So I always want to check. But that story is buried in a much less chronological, much more elusive, imagistic, and fragmented story. Could you speak about fragmentation and why it becomes attractive to you?
Well, I suppose, you know, first off, it just is, it's that challenge to, you're almost working against yourself. Yes, you have a story, the novel is a story of some sort, and yet you don't want a story. You want to say to your reader, okay, there's sort of a story here, but there's lots of other things, too. And I really want you to look at those, too. But I know you've got to have some kind of story. I want a story when I read, and you've got to have some kind of story. So I'll sort of give it to you. But I also want you to look at the language, and I want you to look at the character, and I want you to look at the story in three or four different ways. And don't believe me. Put it together. See what's happening. It's almost contradicting yourself in some ways. You're saying, here are these characters, and they act this way, but see how they sometimes act this way. And if you look at them at one time, you can see who they are, but if you look at them another time, and if you look at through someone else's eyes, you'll see them another way again. I worried that sometimes it's asking the reader too much, that it's...
Well, I find that reading these paragraphs is such a moving experience, that you are moving through a world like a child's world within comprehension, but more than like a child's world, like someone who is avoiding. Children can't help but avoid, but adults do it all the time.
Yes, yeah.
And that the prose has been cloaked in a way to let the reader gradually find what these characters are systematically leaving out. And that there are these moments of Chekhovian richness, but that they are sort of exemplary moments, that most of the time there's a battery of, as I keep suggesting, vacancies
yes.
that are being
yes.
you know, focused on.
Yes, yeah. It's in some ways, it's a way, I think, of getting the reader, one, to pay more attention. Yes, you've got to pay a lot of attention. All right, pay a lot of attention, and here's a few rewards along the way so that you'll know enough to trust me. Then when you get to the end, I think you'll find out that everything you need to know is here. But in the meantime, when you don't know that, here's a nice detail. Do you like that? You know? And if you like that one, I'll give you another one. And if you get to the end of the chapter, you'll even find out something about the story.
It's a very, interesting way of going through the book. I like it. You know, it's sort of like prowling in an attic or, proceeding through darkness. You know, there's a kind of funhouse effect.
But, I suppose, to write fiction in the first place, you have to have a sense that nothing is really what it appears to be, that there's something... There's something more, that there's another way of looking at it, that it fits into something else, and the challenge is to get that into a novel where everything means other things and is rich with meaning, and yet is comprehensible in the limits of the story that makes up the novel.
I've been speaking to Alice McDermott, the author of At Weddings and Wakes, and thank you. I've enjoyed this a lot.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.